ebook publishers and marketing services company, Just Imagine It, Inc. presents Get Behind Me, Now Stay There, your favorite fun-filled, informative podcast available on iTunes, PRX, and right here locally on KSKQ 89.5 FM, Ashland, Oregon, art and entertainment news and views. Today's podcast is brought to you by the fine folks at Downpour.com, the one stop for all your audio and digital book needs. Join the Downpour Audiobook Club and save up to 50% on digital downloads, exclusive member-only deals and promotions with no commitment, and you can cancel at any time. Only $9.99 per month. And be sure to check out our new book rental program. That's Downpour.com.
On this episode, we talk to Sarah Packiam in Germany during her European tour. We catch up with author and musician Jonathan Taylor in Bulgaria a day after his birthday, and New York Times bestseller Go Set a Watchman in our Downpour.com special feature, right after the news you want to know.
Loving you is hard, being here is harder. You take the wheel, I don't want to do this anymore. It's so surreal, I can't survive if this is all that's real. All I want to do is get high, better beach, get high, better beach, get high. All I want to do is get by, better beach, get by, baby, baby, bye, bye.
Hello, I'm Charlie Stanton.
I'm Maya Seligman.
I'm Holly Lorian Adams.
I'm Kayla Elrod.
Hi, I'm Sean Mark Nipper.
And I'm Jerry Renfro. Here's a look at our top stories in the art and entertainment world. Jennifer Lawrence. I hate to say it, but I love Jennifer Lawrence. I think she's adorable. Like, she's a giant seven-year-old. It cracks me up. I remember a year or two ago, I think it was in 2012, when she was promoting Silver Linings Playbook, she got to meet one of her idols, Jeff Bridges, and as soon as he, like, saw her, she ran away, like, giggling, and then she got a chance to actually talk to him. And it was just, it's great to see that level of enthusiasm. And this year she got to meet another one of her heroes, and it was all caught on camera. Bill Murray, for the first time ever, was at Comic-Con. He's never been before. He was promoting his new movie, Rock the Casbah, and Jennifer Lawrence, like a seven-year-old again, just was just giddy getting the chance to meet Bill Murray. You know, Jennifer, of course, was promoting Mockingjay Part 2, and we don't know what they talked about. I'm sure it was amusing. You know, Bill Murray is almost always a funny guy. I remember, too, it's almost like becoming a trend. Jack Nicholson, I think she met Jack Nicholson at the Oscars a couple years ago.
Yeah, that's right. I remember that.
That was so cool.
It was so funny because you see he, like, puts on the Jack Nicholson charm, and she bought it completely. She was, like, just giddy. And it just, I don't know, it cracks me up because there's so many people, you know, that seem to get jaded, especially when you're a huge star and people are constantly wanting your attention. She just is refreshing, very refreshing. It's not much. I wanted to share it because I thought it was cute.
Well, and she had a photo that she'd stored on her phone and it depicted a $5 bill with Murray's face on it.
That's actually she'd become a really popular t-shirt.
Oh, yeah. So she was kind of obsessed with him. And so that was what happened before they met.
She had that on her phone at the time?
Yeah.
Oh, that's funny. Yeah, I didn't know that part.
And I know what you mean about her being a fresh face and, you know, like full of enthusiasm. Remember when she won the Academy Award for Best Actress for Silver Linings Playbook? Great movie.
Yep.
And the scenes afterwards at the after party, you know, Jack Nicholson was there being Jack Nicholson.
Of course.
She was sitting at a table and they were interviewing her about winning Best Actress. And Jack Nicholson came up behind her, you know, and put his arms around her. And he goes, "Hey, congratulations. How's it going? You know, we should meet afterwards." And she's like, "Oh my God, what?" You know, she goes, "Yeah, I'll be waiting for you."
He puts on the sunglasses. Yeah. And then I think she said something like, "He's still behind me, isn't he?" Yeah. And her friend was like, "Yeah." And she's like,
"Turn around.
I'll bring a bottle of champagne."
Yeah.
And, you know, from celebrity to celebrity, Maya, we were talking about the rise of YouTube celebrities, weren't we, mm-hmm. earlier?
Yeah. These days, a lot of artists can become famous by their own accord through YouTube. And something that has been really popular has been the postmodern jukebox of YouTube. Yeah. They have more than 200 million YouTube views and 100 million subscribers. And I love it because I love covers. It's so interesting when artists take songs that I like or maybe even I don't like and they put their own spin on it completely. And so producer-arranger Scott Bradley, he creates this retro jazzy kind of style for his remakes on popular radio standards. So, for example, there was a flapper version of Iggy Azalea's song Fancy. Oh. And Kesha's song Timber was transformed into a 50s doo-wop kind of style.
Oh, yeah.
Really fun. Awesome. Yeah. So the songs are performed live weekly in a really simple setting. Initially, it was Bradley's apartment, his living room, by really an evolving group of musicians and singers. And then the videos are posted to YouTube. And they now have a revolving roster of about 50 performers. And it's a cast of both vocalists and musicians. And there's even like tap dancers and tambourine players. And there's a 7-foot-tall clown. Yeah. So it's a really fun phenomenon. And something that has gotten a little bit of attention is that it has ties to reality TV. Because two of the group's regulars are American Idol season 10 fan favorites, Haley Reinhart and Casey Abrams. But it gets a little complicated because Bradley says he's not really a fan of TV talent shows because his own arrangements have been uncredited and they've been featured on network reality competition shows, including American Idol. So they take his song and they do it without giving him any credit. Yeah. And so that's something that he's getting tired of people ripping him off like that. It's such an interesting thing, and he is waiting for one of the original artists to make a cameo in one of the videos, because that sure
that
would be
so cool.
And they're on tour, so let's go see them in Portland in December.
They're touring the Postmodern Jukebox?
Postmodern Jukebox. Wow. Yeah, so look up Postmodern Jukebox if you want to see a range of really fun videos.
Yeah, and their wardrobes, too, are gorgeous.
Oh, I know, aren't they? Just to follow up, the performer later tweeted that PMJ was her inspiration. So Bradley was happy with that. Yeah.
You know, that's interesting because we had a discussion months ago, and I'm trying to remember the exact context, but, you know, the fact of the matter is, like, let's look at this one here, Creep, okay? Radiohead owns the rights to that. It's their song, right? So what role, I remember what it was. Remember the lawsuit regarding Blurred Lines with Pharrell and Robin Thicke, right?
Robin Thicke.
Okay, so, you know, it was tagged as being too similar to, I think, was it Marvin Gaye's song or
who
was
it? I think I know where you're going with this.
Yeah, it's like what role does the arrangement versus the
proper? There is no rule. You know what? You can cover anybody's song you want as long as you give them credit.
Right.
In my own opinion, and I think this is a correct one.
Of course you do.
There are so many versions when people do like American Idol or any of these shows, right? I'd say, you know, half of them, if not, you know, 70% of them come out and do a cover song.
Right.
And they do it in their own style.
Right.
And even though it may sound, you know, very few of them are identical to what the original artist did, but they do their version of it.
Right.
But it's just an issue if they're copying another cover that's already been done.
Right. Like if you did it yourself, that's one thing. But if you're taking what somebody else did, their version of it, it's kind of that murky gray area.
It's like, you know, again, you know, my favorite group, the Beatles, right? You know, everybody, you know, has covered their songs.
Right, of course.
And I remember, you know, McCartney talking about it, and they said, you know, do you mind your songs being covered by everybody? You know, what do you think of it? And he goes, I don't care. He goes, and that's fine. Anybody can do it. You know, and there's no legal boundaries. He says they can't do it because, you know, they still, you know, get the royalties as the writers. But the thing is, like he was saying, he goes, you know what? He goes, I've heard people do cover songs of our music that I like better than we did.
Right. And it happens.
You know? Mm-hmm. Right, and then, you know, there was like, you know, he gave the example of Got to Get You Into My Life. He goes, it was a great song when we came out in the 60s, you know, and everything like that. He goes, but I heard a remake of it, and it was done by like a Kool and the Gang or somebody like that, and they changed it completely around. I mean, it was like, you know, night and day songs, you know, with the, you know, the harmonies, got to get, and they just jazzed it all up, and, you know, and he goes, I loved it. You know, he goes, I wish I would have thought of it.
You know what I find interesting is I was living in the Bay Area for 13 years a year ago, and watching the progression of bands, like original bands not doing as well, and AC/DC, an all-cover, all-female AC/DC cover band, Stung.
That's funny.
These guys just do nothing but Police songs. And so the niche is doing the covers. And, you know, in my personal opinion, there's two ways to do a cover. Either you completely 100% nail it and honor the people that did it, or you make it so much your own that it's really the original. And that's where that creativity comes out. And it's really too bad that they're not able to take credit for, you know, remixing and recreating something so fabulous.
And that's the point I was trying to make, is that legally they're okay, but that doesn't mean that it's morally right. You know, that's what I'm saying, is like, if Jukebox arranges it a certain way and you're going to use that arrangement, I think you should credit them for that. You know, you don't owe them any obligation. They don't legally own the rights to the song. But if they put in the effort to make that particular arrangement, I think it's the least you could do to say, hey, you know, this is Curtis. You know, we heard this arrangement here, or thank you, you know.
Yeah, you know, that'd be a cool thing to do. But, you know, I think power is with the people, you know. And if you get 200 million people watching your video, man, they know who you are.
YouTube has really, really come into its own. And I just want to say one thing. I was going to try to find a way to squeeze this in. Does anybody watch the epic rap battles of history on YouTube?
I do.
It's these guys, Nice Peter and Epic Lloyd, that take historical and fictional characters and do rap battles against each other as those characters.
Yeah.
I've obsessed.
Seen that.
Yeah.
The Lego one? Have you seen that?
What's that?
Zeus versus Thor.
Yeah,
Lego
the Lego one.
Oh
yeah.
My God.
The Russian one is the one I've been watching all the time. But if you guys are listening to the show, Nice Peter or Epic Lloyd, send me an
epic
email.
Epic rap battles of history.
Yeah, it's fantastic. I just want to say thank you for the wonderful work. All right, we can go back.
Well, speaking about YouTube, somebody who just like gets, you know, I don't know, all kinds of play on YouTube, you know, and well-deserved, is Ozzy. And Sean's got a story about him.
Yeah, you know, a while back.
I'm not talking about Ozzy Nelson.
You know, no. If you get in an argument with your band, which I've done many times, and you quit and you pack up your drums and leave, what do you do? Well, when you're not a rock star, it's, you know, you're on Craigslist. Right? But if you're Ozzy and you're not getting along with your bandmates in Black Sabbath, which I just wanted for the record, I started out listening to Wham and Madonna, but then I went right to Black Sabbath after that.
So
I'm a huge fan of Ozzy.
How's it going with Cindy Lauper
and
you?
No, it's so...
Girls just want to have Sean.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness. Is it the toenail polish that's giving it away? All right. So it's really funny to realize that Ozzy, I think he can barely stand up these days. I think the mic stand is holding him up.
It looks like it.
Pretty much. Is starting a super group with some other people that may have not got along with their band. So he's going to join up with Slash.
All right.
Guns N' Roses. Who's phenomenal. He's going to join. Well, he's got Geezer Butler, the bassist from Black Sabbath.
So yeah, you
got
to take Geezer.
Yeah, I mean, that's the bass, right? So Tom Morello from Rage Against the Machine, phenomenal. Wow. They don't have a drummer yet, but they could call maybe Dave Lombardo from Slayer. He doesn't get along with his band anymore.
You should be their agent, Sean.
Oh, really? I should.
You could be their wizard.
Their wizard.
Maybe me?
Yeah.
Sure?
Yeah.
Maybe Vinnie Paul from Pantera. Actually, he got along with his band, but, you know, he's too busy running a strip club in Texas now.
Right.
So, but they are going to be playing.
It goes on, man.
It does. Yeah, for tips and tips only. I think they're going to be playing in New Orleans, City Park, in October. The 30th through the 1st. And I guess it's a big thing. So they're going to have Florence and the Machine, Zach Brown Band, Deadmau5, and Chance the Rapper, Jane's Addiction. So it'll be interesting to see how they get along.
You know, that's kind of a really good lineup here, this voodoo music.
Yeah, Voodoo Fest.
Voodoo Fest, yeah. And,
sounds really great.
Jane's Addiction is fantastic. You know, I mean, I know they are just one of those bands that you don't hear about them all the time, but every time they put something out, it's just like, you know, fantastic.
Just out there working, yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, I've seen them several times before, and they're always the same members. They'll go like 5-6 years at a time. They were the guys that started Lollapalooza.
Yeah, yeah, you know, yeah, absolutely.
Back in the day.
I wonder if they'll let Axl sit in for a couple of songs.
Axl Rose.
Well, considering it's
you imagine Axl Rose and Ozzy trying to sing together on stage?
I mean, both like weaving back and forth, holding each other up.
Insane. You know, the crazy thing about this for me, it's so funny. I remember in a film studies class talking about how, you know, having 20 A-list actors in a movie doesn't guarantee it's going to be Oscar worthy. You know, it takes the right blend of A, B, C, and D level actors and extras, you know, to make a piece of art like that. But it seems in music, you really can just fantasy draft it. No. You know what I mean? It's like every time I think of a suit, you know, like the Highwayman, you know what I mean? It's like you just take 4 or 5, like, guys who are awesome at what they do and bam, put them together and you've got gold. You know what I mean?
There was another band that got together Sammy Hagar took the bass player from Van Halen, and Joe Satriani, amazing guitarist, and then Chad Smith, and they had a band called Chickenfoot. And that did really well, actually. But there's a...
Yeah, you know,
Van Halen's not getting back together anytime soon.
I remember them. I heard their music, and they're all good musicians.
Velvet Revolver. There's another one.
Steve Vai played with David Lee Roth, ironically enough, and so did Michael Anthony.
Yeah,
Lee Roth. And the drummer was from the Red Hot Chili Peppers.
Yeah,
but they did it, you know, and they sounded good. But I heard Sammy Hagar and Howard Stern asked him, you know, so Chickenfoot, now you're making your big thing, you know, it's your career, and he goes, I got to be honest with you, man. He goes, the biggest thing that ever happened to me was being in Van Halen.
I thought he was going to say Cabo Wabo, but...
No, he said, you know, to be honest, he goes, the biggest thing that ever happened in my career, he goes, and I was a star before.
Yeah.
You know, it was when I was in Van Halen, I was in a superstar group. He goes, you still see that when they turn out. He goes, they tour with Dave, everybody's older. He goes, but Dave's still a great showman. And that's what I wasn't.
There was a TV show called Rockstar that they were trying to put together a supergroup, and I think they called them Supernova, that had Tommy Lee on drums, Jason Newsted from Metallica.
Metallica, yeah.
And then the guitarist, Michael, somebody from Guns N' Roses.
Came out. Yeah, exactly.
You just have to make it metal.
I would love to see something like that, you know, if you would post it up to YouTube or Facebook or something like that. And speaking of Facebook, man, Holly's got a fantastic story on this.
Yeah, this man got jobs at Yahoo, Facebook, Airbnb, all without a college degree because he was good at serving lattes.
And we've heard, John, how about
Man, I missed my calling. Why didn't I go down?
Was he serving lattes at these jobs? Or
No. I mean, we've all heard about people who were working at coffee shops who got discovered. But this guy, Mike Curtis, walked away from Alta Vista to join Yahoo and Facebook and Airbnb without even having a college degree because of his latte services. In high school, Curtis worked at a coffee shop serving up hop drinks to businessmen and a new tech company across the street. Curtis started pestering the owner about getting an internship. He told a crowd of 3,000 aspiring tech employees at Internapalooza, you just have to go get it.
That's a thing?
Yeah, it's a thing.
Everything a palooza.
I gotta admit, I find where Curtis is coming from to be quite a good strategy. The owner finally caved in and gave Curtis a shot. He gave him a shot.
Yeah, I get it.
It was a shot of a double espresso shot.
Yeah.
And he also had to answer phones and stuff, but he said, you know, you can't be afraid to do a little bit of work. Curtis says that it's what taught him how to deal with customers after all. So he took his road. He ended up that he worked at several different businesses. Alta Vista bought the company in 1990, leaving Curtis with the decision to go to college or move west and work with Alta Vista. And he decided he would take the road west out to Silicon Valley in 1999 for going college degree. From there, he worked as an engineer at AOL and a healthcare company before he signed on with Yahoo. Spent 7 years with the company, working his way up from lead engineer for Yahoo Mail before he came to the realization that you should make sure that one day whatever company you join is working as hard for you as you are working for it. Gotta look for opportunities and shed your ego, Curtis says.
Well, he had all that energy from all the coffee he made, and so he had to give it to someone.
That's right. He went on to Airbnb in 2013 because he felt like it really mattered. It was also a chance to get in with a company early, and now the home rental market is reportedly closing and at $1.5
billion round. Billion with a B.
Billion.
That's a lot of lattes there.
That's a lot of lattes.
He always measures currency in lattes. Like, how many?
And I bet he says, thanks a latte. Very often.
And he puts all the money in his wall latte.
Oh.
You know, that's really kind of, it's a great story, very inspiring. And, you know, I am so curious, and I don't know if anybody here, you know, has ever tried any of the Airbnb.
Mm-hmm. I'm about to. So
you're going to Paris, right? Or France?
Yeah, but I'm going to do it when I'm in San Diego, and
And
then when we're there, we have places that we're going to stay. But I always think, like, is this going to be sketchy, or is it going to be like a good kind of cheap experience? You've done it.
My dad has, and he's had really good experiences.
Oh, good.
Yeah, I've
been
and
heard
then actually,
good things about it.
Yeah,
I helped someone put his house up on it, and he ended up renting it out for a whole month because he had to go away, and it worked out great. People were really happy. He got a good amount of money, and it was a win-win.
I think the vast majority of stories are success stories. I mean, there are negatives. We've discussed positives and negatives here a few months back. We talked about Airbnb. The only problem I see with it is there's a lot of scrutiny, kind of like with what's going on with Uber, you know, versus taxis and Airbnb versus hotels. You know, you've got entrenched industries that have a vested financial interest in making sure these things don't work. They're influencing local politicians to pass regulations. In fact, I believe San Diego is one of the areas that's under heavy scrutiny. I just read an article about it a couple of days ago. A woman got fined somewhere in the neighborhood of $25,000, I think, for renting her house out as an Airbnb. So it's one of those things that's still, you know, seeking mainstream acceptance. But I think it's inevitable. I think it, just like I think Uber was inevitable, that, you know, crowd sharing is the way of the future.
Well, I don't think so much crowd sharing. It's just that the advent of social networking, it allows you now with new technology to do things like this.
Yeah, you know, see who's renting.
Yeah, Uber, for example, you know, they tried, you know, the taxi union tried to shut them down in New York City, but they got overruled because, you know, it doesn't apply. You know?
Right.
They don't care if you're in union or not. Everybody has a right, you know, to make a living.
Right.
And but by having social, you know, media now, instead of having to get out the Yellow Pages and look up and call somebody, like, I call Maya and see if this thing's, you know, really for real, stuff like that. I mean, now you can go on and find out about all this stuff. And they don't just do this in the United States, man. They're doing it around the world. You know, yeah. So that's the thing that's really cool about it, you know?
Well, I find Mike's story very inspiring, and it shoots for everyone to really go after the mission impossible.
Ah, yeah. Dun, 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 dun. So have you guys seen this movie?
Yes.
You've seen it? One?
Yes.
Yeah, and you have 2 fist bumps. That's what you give it.
You know, I was entertained.
Yeah, I hear the reviews are really great. It seems like one of those movies that is actually worth going into the theaters
to
and
see
watching.
It in the theater.
Yeah, because of the action. If you see the trailer starts off, basically he's playing an IMF agent, Ethan Hunt, and he dives into this area to retrieve a computer chip that will lead him closer to the film's villain. Along with having to hold his breath the whole time, he must keep away from the large crane that is circling around the safe. So the big wow moment is that Tom Cruise is doing this stunt himself. Completely off.
He does them all.
So
himself,
he does, yeah, that's what he's known for. He does all of his own stunts. He did jump off the 120-foot ledge, but it wasn't like he was trying to shoot into the little funnel. That was actually all CGI. But he really did do the jump. And then the underwater set was filled with 20 feet high water, and he had to hold his breath for the entire scene. They had to hire a teacher to teach Tom how to mentally overpower his lungs and tell his brain, I don't need air. And I'm like, Tom Cruise, you don't even need to breathe.
You can afford somebody to do this for you. Yeah. Or are you saying, because I'm Tom Cruise. I don't need to breathe.
Right. That's where I think he's coming from.
How long did he hold his breath for the scene?
6 minutes is what it was. He held it for 6 minutes.
You know, saw Tom Cruise on Jimmy Fallon, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they did like a real good
lip sync battle.
Uh-huh. It was really cool. They were both really good. Jimmy Fallon's really good. Tom Cruise was a lot better than I thought he would be. He's actually really good. Well, you know, the thing that impressed me is when I saw him, it's like Tom Cruise is standing next to Jimmy Fallon, and they, you know, Cruise has got to be a good 25 years older than Jimmy Fallon. And they look like they're the same age.
Yeah, he's Holy in moly. Great shape. I don't know what kind of stuff he's done, who he sold what to, but he's amazing.
There's actually a documentary about it.
There is. And I guess the director was saying, Wade Eastwood was saying that on 2 or 3 occasions he had to bring him up because he felt like he was down for too long. And Tom Cruise
like
came
the
up.
Director who killed Tom.
Right? Yeah, you don't want that. You would be out.
But
for
he probably
a while.
Has good life insurance and health insurance. I mean, Tom Cruise better.
That was Wade Eastwood was the director, right? The guy who did Edge of Tomorrow with him. Oh God, I just watched that again last night. Such a good movie. Now I really want to see the new one.
You need to.
Yeah, Who and. Was that? Oh, yeah. Well, Tom Cruise came up and he's like, what are you doing? I was right in the moment. I'm acting. And the director is like, I know. I was just too real and I wasn't comfortable and maybe you were going to die. So I don't know. And, you know, this Mission Impossible, it just keeps on exciting its viewers. It's not killing this, 19-year project of Mission Impossible. It just keeps continuing and growing.
Neil Cruz is like, you know, he never got like Robert Downey Jr. He has done with Iron Man and all these guys, you know, they have these movies that they keep making, right? These franchise movies, you know? And Cruise always would make something very different from the, you know, every single movie. Mm-hmm. But he did the Mission Impossible, and so now he's done like five. Or
yeah,
like,
yeah. This is the fifth one, yeah.
You know, it just seems, you know, to have really worked out for him well, because like I was saying earlier, when he was on Fallon and he asked him about doing the own sets, he goes, so when the guy's hanging out of the airplane, he goes, that's really you. And he goes, yeah, that was me.
Yeah.
And, you know, Cameron Diaz was on at the same time, right? And they had done a movie together, Night and Day, where all this more stuff.
Oh, right.
Yeah, that was actually good. So it was like a romantic comedy.
He goes, come on. That's not really. He goes, but those motorcycle scenes in Night and Day, Tom was riding the motorcycle, right. And she goes, yeah, that was him.
Wow. Yeah, I don't think there's any Tom Cruise movies without him riding a motorcycle.
Then, maybe that's his thing, like Samuel L. Jackson has to say.
Like two things. I run.
He didn't do a Western, and there was no motorcycle.
Oh, okay. Right. Back to the Future didn't show up yet.
Yeah. Far and away.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, and probably no motorcycle.
But the thing they were saying, you know, the director from this movie, from this Mission Impossible, saying, he goes, you know what? Even if Tom Cruise had never been a movie star, never been an actor, he would have been a stuntman.
Right.
Yeah. He is that good. He does all of his own stunts because he was saying the thing that with him is that because he has such star power, it's the only reason he gets to do his own stunts.
Wow. Right.
Because he will refuse to do the movie unless he does his own stunts. Most insurance companies for the movies will say, like, no way.
No way. Uh-huh. Yeah. There's no You're not way putting Christian our $20 million dollar in.
No way Christian Bale is, you know, is holding his breath for 6-7 minutes right. while hanging off an airplane.
Right.
You know?
Man. Yeah, that's
cool. That's one of the many benefits of being Tom Cruise.
That's right. And plus, you know, maybe you can video call him on Facebook.
That's what I was just about to say. Tom, if you're out there, why don't you hit me up on – actually, I don't use Facebook, but –
Oh, sorry. You're the one.
The last one.
I'm like
left.
The one person on earth that doesn't use Facebook.
Yeah.
And my mom.
How many illnesses do you have, though?
So Facebook, of course, in their effort to take over the world, God bless our benevolent leader, Mark Zuckerberg, is now adding video calling to Messenger in an effort to take on Skype and Google Hangouts. You know, the social networking site has now added video calling to its Messenger app. And
Facebook is the Tom Cruise of
social media.
You know what I think that's about? It's a ploy. Back when we had cell phones, we didn't have data. We needed minutes. And that's how cell phone companies made their money. But now you get free minutes, unlimited texting. So where's the moneymaker? It's the data. So it's the music streaming and it's the video streaming because you got to eat up your data. And then they charge you for more when you run out. So hey, I feel like they're giving you all kinds of opportunities to, you know, you don't need minutes anymore. It's the data that you're using, and that's where they make their money.
They might be your data if you.
But Facebook doesn't benefit from that. They unless don't the your data provider.
Unless the cellular companies are paying off Facebook to do. We're starting to sound a little cray cray.
Yeah.
I don't think that's, you know, that's the case. I think they're just doing it, you know, just to stay relevant.
It's just the next step, you know, because now video chatting is not the Jetsons anymore. It's not the stuff of science fiction. You know, I FaceTime with people all the time. Skype chatting.
Like FaceTime on Apple only works, you know,
when you're connected to Wi-Fi.
When you're connected to Wi-Fi,
right?
Unless you buy extra plan.
Right. Yeah, because you're going to blow through your data otherwise. Right. Yeah, absolutely. Facebook had integrated with Skype a few years back. This seems like the logical next step, you know, to do their own thing. Because, you know, recently they also added the ability to, like, send payments to friends, as did Snapchat. There's this race, it seems, between the major social media to be the one-stop shopping for everybody's needs. You know, you want to call somebody, you can use Facebook. You want to video chat, you need to send them some money. You know, whatever it is you need to do on the internet, Facebook wants to have a piece of that. They want to be able to provide you. You don't need to go outside. And it makes perfect sense. Charlie's a big fan of Facebook. We talk about them all the time. What do you think? I mean, this makes sense, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think it's just another thing, a feature that they're adding, you know, so that people are more encouraged to use it. They already are.
And an interesting piece of how Facebook works is that it has been known that the way the human mind works is just like with slot machines, you just want to do one more, just one more. When you're scrolling through, it can be an addictive thing for the human mind. Like, let me just keep scrolling, just one more. Let me just see one more picture. 2 hours later, you're still looking at Facebook. So it is an addictive kind of thing because it taps into neurologically a way of that compulsion.
I want a kind of privacy policy they're going to have with that the new video chat.
Well, you know, it's the same as, you know, and that's a good point that you bring up, because, you know what, any message you send on Facebook, if you just want it to be between me and you, or you want to post up pictures and you want it to be between just me and you or people, friends or whatever, right?
Right.
There's already right in there. You can just click on private.
Private, yeah.
And you send it, you know, and it only goes to Jerry and Maya and Holly and Kayla and me, you know, and Cyrus. Okay. It only goes to us. Right. We can't even share it. If I wanted to share it with somebody else, I found it out the hard way. I clicked on a share and says, this is a private message. It right. You can only share within the group that it was sent to.
I got something interesting, too, about Facebook. I put a post up saying I wanted to connect with Will Smith or Johnny Depp or Kim Novak, a couple different people. Facebook threw me the bone of James Franco. So the next morning, James Franco says, sure, I'll be your friends. Now I'm friends with James Franco on Facebook.
Right? I want to be friends with James Franco.
And, I have such a crush on him. Oh, my God. Will you
hope he messages
to
me the next time I see him?
Have you seen James Franco and Seth Rogen do Naked and Afraid?
Yes.
That would be amazing.
They did. They it's did like hilarious. A spoof, like a spoof kind of thing it. Of it. Yeah,
on the motorcycle.
I just watched. Yeah. This is the end. The movie.
Wait, no,
they
no,
did
not
where
that
they play
one.
Themselves.
But,
oh yeah, this
oh,
is
that's,
the end.
That's funny.
I love that.
That was a good movie.
So many levels.
I think I was thinking of another one.
But yeah, but I know thing. What you're talking about too.
You know, Charlie, like, I find that interesting. What you shared about that. One thing I find interesting, really, about it is why isn't that the default? I wonder why do you have to. You have to opt into the privacy. There was a guy I read just recently who had an internship scheduled at Facebook, and he figured out that you know, if you don't opt in, every time you post a message or a picture or whatever, where you are, your location information is publicly available if you know where to look for it. So he created a Marauder's map similar to like Harry Potter, where you could track, you know, people's movements based on that, you know, and Facebook, of course, was like, glad, you know, just like any company, they want to know what these, you know, how these things are working. But I'm curious as to why that's not.
Well, you know, it's a very intricate program, and
it's a lot of parts.
Actually, Facebook is one of the few companies out there. They pay hackers, and people to break into their system.
And I've actually, you can see anyone's photos. Like I found a way to do it. Like, basically, you just take the URL and you can share it with anyone, even if it's not. Even if they don't want to share it with anyone else, all you have to do is, well, yeah, because I, you know, after being involved in the computer
you
world,
you should tell Facebook that, and they'll give you money for it, and they'll fix it.
But that's
what they do.
So all those pictures of breastfeeding, you can just click the URL before they get taken down.
Like how you go to breastfeeding.
Yeah, I've got a whole collection.
All I was about that is I was young and I needed money.
Oh, you're breastfeeding.
Hey, I've tried it. You'll do whatever you can if you got a 4-month-old that's screaming and the mom's not around. I've tried it.
You know, Facebook and, you know, and all this stuff, you know, it's new technology and Airbnb, it's all this stuff is just, you know, great.
Where do you go when you need to know? Go to Jerry Renfro, he knows. Where do you go when you need to know? Go to Jerry Renfro, he knows.
I'm Jerry Renfro, and I'm the guy in the know. In honor of the NWA biopic Straight Out of Compton, we're going to play a little game called Straight Out of the Office. If your coworkers were rappers.
I love
nice.
That.
All right.
We all love our coworkers, don't we? Sure we do. Okay, so according to a scientific survey, 4 out of 5 coworkers are annoying. There are many ways to deal with annoying coworkers, but obviously the most effective way is to picture them as rappers. Picturing your coworkers as rappers makes you laugh and provides a helpful nickname that can be used when talking about them behind their backs. Here are a few of my favorites. 2 Cent, the master of unsolicited opinions. When 2 Cent asks if he can tell you what he thinks, it's a rhetorical question. So you play along and say yes, then sit there nodding. Doesn't matter if it's an email he wasn't originally sent or a meeting he wasn't originally invited to. He's always there and ready to share his thoughts.
Got 2 cents, I'm gonna throw them in.
Yeah. Ice cubicle. Never leaves his cubicle. No matter what you do, you can't get this coworker out of his cubicle. He skips meetings, he skips lunch, he sometimes even skips going home. If you approach his cubicle, he treats you like an alien from some faraway planet, which is exactly how you feel about him.
Stapler?
The notorious WFH, never in the office. Like clockwork, you get an email from this coworker every Monday, Wednesday, and or Friday saying he's working from home. You've started using his desk for cupcake parties. K, Kendrick Lamarter. This is my favorite. Kendrick Lamarter volunteers for everything, then complains about their workload. If this coworker is already overloaded with work, why does he keep volunteering for more? Probably because he loves complaining that he worked all weekend and hasn't slept in days. Nitpicky Minaj. Nothing is ever good enough. No one expects perfection except Nitpicky Minaj. No matter how hard you try to distract her with glaringly obvious mistakes, she skips past those and points out 10 ridiculously tiny things that no one else will care about. Eminem BA, the intern, or also known as way too excited to be here. Eminem BA is scheduling meetings for 8 a.m., writing 20-page documents, and always wants to pick your brain. The summer never seemed so long. Young Buck, the system, has to do it his way. You want to do it your way? Try again. Young Buck, the system, will never follow the process you set up, even if it did take you a year to do it. You try to teach him a lesson or two, but no matter what you do, nothing gets through. Oh, let's not forget Snoop Snoopy Dog, always looking at your screen. With Snoop Snoopy Dog, you need a screen protector for your screen protector. Whenever he's near, his eyes are darting from your laptop to your phone to your tablet and back again. He should just take a picture, and there's a good chance he has. Young Sneezy, always sick. Young Sneezy is ill, but not in the good way. You tell him to go home, but he says he's fine. Between sneezes and coughs, he's touching your chair, your keyboard, and your monitor. Ew. Which explains why your desk smells like antibacterial soap. Can't wait West. No patience whatsoever. Where's the fire? There is no fire, but he's in a rush anyway. He won't wait for you to get off the phone before he starts talking. Get out of the conference room before he's starting his own meeting. Or finish your sentence before he's actually replied to the email. Nice. And there it is, your co-workers as rappers.
I love it.
That's
I love
really
it.
Really funny.
And now you know.
And that's your art and entertainment news. Keep listening for Downpour special feature.
How am I supposed to sleep when there's no you? It's only me. What do I do? They say that's the way it's supposed to be. You left someone, you set them free, but who wants to? Not me, I'm sorry. This you gotta live. I love you.
Sarah Packiam makes a great impression with her Irish beauty and charm, while her songs make a lasting memory. From Frankfurt, Germany, she spoke with the president of Just Imagine It, Inc., Charlie Stanton.
Still love that guy.
Welcome, everybody, to another special edition on Get Behind Me Now, Stay There. Today, we are really, really privileged to have on Sarah Packiam, and she is just, I'll tell you, a singer that is just wonderful and blowing up the charts. And we're speaking to her from Frankfurt, Germany. And welcome to the show, Sarah.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I'm assuming you just finished up a show there in Germany.
We just actually arrived to Germany yesterday. It's my day off in Frankfurt.
Oh.
Some shoes. And yesterday we were in Luxembourg, so we did a show in Luxembourg. And before that, we were in Paris, Valencia, and Madrid.
Oh, wow.
And tomorrow we'll be in Berlin.
Oh, you're going to play Berlin? Oh. That's a wild city, man.
I'm excited to go. I've heard a lot of great things about it, so I'm excited to check it out.
Yeah, we have a singer. She's from Sweden, and we saw her when she toured in America, and cool. She was going back home to Europe, and we asked her, if she was going back to Sweden, and she goes, no, I'm going to Berlin. And we asked her, why Berlin? She goes, because that is the music capital of Europe.
Wow.
You know?
Well, I'm about to experience it. I'm excited. Let's see. Only good things I hear.
Yeah. So, how are you enjoying, Europe now? You're from Ireland, right?
I'm from Ireland, so I'm feeling quite at home. And just the hour change was a little difficult for me, the jet lag. But we're 4 in the morning in the beginning. But now it's great, and the crowd has been great, and really good response to the new songs and the new album. And yeah, it's positive. Excited.
I bet it was. And so you're having a lot of fun in Europe, huh?
Yes, yes. It's a fun road trip. We rented a car, and we've got the guitar in the back of the car, and going city to city, country to country, and yeah, I can't complain.
Now, I gotta ask you, are you gonna play in Ireland while you're there?
Ireland's not happening this trip. Possibly the next time I come over, I'll do England and Ireland. I gotta do the UK and of course, go back home to Ireland. But this trip was mainland, really, and rental car friendly.
yeah, exactly.
So, yeah, we're an indie tour. It's fun. We're starting out, but this is the way it happens. It's grassroots, and if people come to the show and they know my songs or they come and say, hi, I'm so happy to meet new fans and new people and just, yeah, meeting friends along the way, really.
Oh, it sounds like a wonderful trip, and, you know, I would love to be the driver. I would love to even just drive the van, you know?
I know. Tagging along, you'd be surprised. We're meeting friends all over the place that are squeezing in the car, squeezing in the hotel room. Say no more.
Okay. Is there a song on again that just like you just like every night you perform it, you're just like, you know, yeah, I can't wait till we get to that song because I love doing this song.
So I think I would feel that way about Messed Up.
I love that song.
That's normally my closer of the night, and I have fun performing it, and I think I like to see people groove with it, and it's an upbeat song, so that would have to be my favorite.
Your new album is called Again, and
yes,
it is so good, man, I tell you.
You like it.
Well, I first saw a video for it, you know, for the song Messed Up, and mm-hmm. then so I got, you know, intrigued in it, and I said, you know, I'm going to check this out. You know, I went and I got the album, and I put it on my iPhone, man, and then I was like listening to it, then I put it on my tablet, and then I was just like telling my friends about it, and I was just like, man, you know, you are just very, very talented.
Oh, thank you very much.
Matter of fact, for our listening audience around the world here, your new single is called Messed Up. Let's hear a little bit of that right now. So when are you going to be coming back to America, or are you going to stay in Europe for a while?
Back in action, performing and doing some radio, hopefully some more radio, and promoting the new album. And I'm looking forward to coming home, but enjoying Europe at the same time. I mean, I'm from here, so I feel comfortable here in a ways. Although, I have to say, getting in a car and driving 3 hours and arriving in a new country where they speak a totally different language, there's something really special about that. I just learned how to count 1 to 10 in the last country, and I will learn the next country.
Oh, my goodness. So now you, Los Angeles is your home in America, right?
Miami.
Oh, well, Miami. Oh,
yeah.
Oh, okay.
I love L.A., but Miami's my hometown.
Yeah, because I noticed that Messed Up was shot in the L.A. area.
Yes, Messed Up was L.A., and City Little Love Songs was Miami.
Oh, that was Miami.
Yeah, it was a little island in Miami.
Yeah, Silly Little Love Songs. I love the song, and it's really kind of crazy, and, you know, and this is a compliment to you, because I saw the video, and the video is just, you know, it's great. It's outrageous, it's fun, you know, and it's beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And I play it, you know, on my iPod or something, you know, it's just as great. Even without the visuals.
Oh, that's good. That's good. Yeah, it's a storytelling song, so I try to do that. That's my aim, to create a visual with the song. So it was actually written about when I saw a photograph.
Uh-huh.
And I could tell that it was their first love. And the song pretty much came out in a very few minutes, just all the lyrics and the music together very quickly, because it was a story in my head that I had to get out about this couple that I saw in a photograph.
Oh, wow. That's great.
You remember First Love, right? It's crazy.
They tell me about it, but you know what? I think everybody remembers First Love, you know?
Yeah.
It's, you know, it's just an experience, you know, for everybody, because it's so, you know, beautiful and so new and everything like that, and the energy that comes with it, you know?
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. Now, you know, we talked about silly little love songs. And so, for again, for all of our listeners around the world, and we have a huge following around the world. And, you know, I want to play some of this song to show people how cool it really is. As you take me far. If I was a medical doctor, I would say right now, you know what? This is an infectious song.
That's a good compliment. I like that.
Yeah. And you just can't get it out of your head, you know? You're just... Yeah.
You know? The chorus is what you have in your head?
Yeah, because it's so simple and it's so beautiful and it's just like, and it applies to everyone that's sitting in this world.
Yeah.
You know, we've all at one time felt like that, you know, because of you, me, you know? Come on, Sarah. I know you've been in love before. Maybe you're in love right now. Who knows? But that's how you feel, you know? Like, so euphoric, yeah. You can't even explain it to people.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. True. I mean, yeah. And it came out pretty spontaneous. So, but, I mean, as I said, I didn't write it for myself. I wrote it for another couple. I was remembering that feeling. And I think we can all relate to that.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, not only can we relate to it, you know, for those of us, you know, that don't have it at the present, you know, we're like, you know, oh, I got to find that again, man.
<laughs> You know? <laughs> It's a big world. There's plenty of people out there. You should get on a European tour. And you never know who you'll meet.
Doing this radio show podcast, we have met so many people around the world. It would just blow your mind. Yeah.
Incredible.
Yeah, it's just...
That's what life is about. Wow.
Right.
That's you know good music then. You know how to spot it.
That's why I'm talking to you. Yeah. So what do you love so much about Miami? Why settle on Miami?
I think it's the blend of all the different, like you said, I mean, even Miami's so diverse. There's people from everywhere and the beach. I miss the mountain slide.
Yeah.
But yeah, and I just feel it's home now.
Yeah, you know, I like Miami. The thing that, you know, I finally put together was that everyone here is in a good mood and they're from, you know, like just about every single country you could think of. They're all on vacation, walking around, having a good time. You know?
Exactly. The vibe is amazing. And they could be the richest guy or the poorest guy, and they're all wearing flip-flops and shirts, yeah. You know? There's no airs and graces. And they all love music.
Right. And you would never know. You know?
That's a good thing. We're just people and having a good time. And, yeah, I love that. I'm hoping to pop down to the Keys and probably be my next trip down to the Keys.
Oh, yeah. Oh, they... Well, I'm sure you've been there before. They'll love...
Yes, I've been. I did some shows there, and I think they play some of my songs down there. I think they like Messed Up as well.
Oh, everyone does.
So I'll go down and sing that a couple times. And have me a few margaritas.
All right, you do that. Okay, I'm going to hold you to it now. I want to hear it, and this song is called Messed Up, and it's for Edward Sant.
It's for you.
Yeah. Okay. Well, listen, I know you're really busy, and it's really late there, and we just want to thank you so much, Sarah, for being on, and we want everyone to go out and get your album. It's called Again, and all your other albums are on there as well. You can go on Spotify and iTunes, you know, everywhere the music is sold. And it's just beautiful. And you have a very nice website, by the way.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. We did it ourselves, actually.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Everything is low-budget indie. It can be done.
You know what? It can all be done. And continue success on your tour. Say hello to everyone in Europe for us. And thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you, Edward.
Okay. We'll talk to you soon. Auf Wiedersehen.
Hey.
Okay, so go to iTunes and get Sarah's new album. It's called Again, and or pick out another one. They're all good. Okay, Sarah, thank you so much.
To learn more about Sarah Pacquiam, visit us on our website at justimagineitinc.com.
Cardiac, heart attack, painted black, you know they never fear the reaper. We'll be right back.
Jonathan Taylor is not only a fantastic singer, he's a great author. And he has a great new series books out called Meet, Memoirs of a Psychopath. And I'm so glad I got a chance to talk with him again for this interview. Welcome, everybody, to a very exciting edition and interview today with Jonathan Taylor. And we're talking to him from Bulgaria. Now, he's an artist of many, many talents, a fantastic singer, as you all know, and an author as well. And we want to talk to him about some of his new projects. And it's just phenomenal. So welcome, Jonathan.
Welcome, and thank you. It's very kind of you. I was 49 yesterday, so I'm a 49-year-old singer.
Well,
there you go. You're very kind. Halfway to 50.
Yeah. Well, let me ease your conscience a little bit, because here in the USA, 49 is the new 48. So
I'm celebrating this year because my 49th was yesterday, but I figured, when I was born, it was zero. So when it was my first birthday, I'd actually already been here for a year. So I'm figuring I'm already 50. And that will kind of ease the pain a bit, won't it? It won't be so difficult next year if I just accept, I'm halfway to 100 already. So I'm celebrating my 50th birthday this year. you're still a young man, I'm sure.
But I want to talk a little bit about your album. On your new album, what is your... And I know you're going to say, I love them all because they're all my babies, but what song in particular do you really fancy?
Off the latest album?
Right.
Right. Wow, that's a very difficult question because I do love them all. There's 15 in all. Wow. If you ask me which song I like most in my whole career, it would be If Only or The Holocaust Denier. But on that album, I think probably one of the most... simplest of ones, probably Shesias Rinchetta, I think now, or Partisan, actually. They're more personal to me because where I live in Bulgaria with my partner Nicola, who's an exceptional photographer, her interest in kind of previous socialist icons is as intense as mine. I write stories about them. She photographs them. And the reason we're living where we are is because this house was a Second World War anti-fascist hideout. So, the anti-Nazis, shall we say, the partisans, would go on their secret missions and come back and hide in this house. And in this village where we live, Krushevo, 10 partisans were executed by a firing squad in the wood. So I think my favorite is Partisan or Shesias Rinchetta, which is six children from the village Yastrebino in English. The youngest was 7, where they were killed by fascists in a firing squad.
Well, what? For our listeners out there, let's hear some of Partisan right now.
That would be great, yeah.
Okay.
The allies of the British that stood in the fascist way. Frank Thompson, BEF. Guided on their way, executed by traitors upon that fateful day. Partisan. Partisan. Partisan.
Now, that is a beautiful song. I like it. But I got to tell you something. And I've been waiting to tell you this, Jonathan, for quite some time. Yeah. Is that, you do a song that, one, the video is just so funny and humorous. And I just love the whole idea behind it. I love Rakia. I love that song. It is so infectious. It's so infectious. I'm just like, I've got to go find me a bottle right now.
Excellent. Well, you're invited to come anytime and drink Rakia. They're all very different. The album's got serious song. There's tragedy, heartbreak, comedy. And, Partisan, the singing style, is very much sung as if I'm delivering a political speech. Whereas the Rakia song, that's just... bloody good old-fashioned fun. The local spirit, your equivalent is moonshine. I remember watching the Dukes of Hazzard, and they'd have a moonshine skill.
Right.
Yeah? So that's what the equivalent is. But it's made out of pears or grapes, and it's distilled in the villages. And it can be up to 50% proof sometimes. And when I first arrived here and somebody gave me a taste of this homemade village rakia, I just said it was like drinking petrol. You know, it's just, how can you drink this stuff? But the more you get into the culture of the place, it's not any more about the taste. It's about the experience of being in a village and getting drunk on rakia.
Right.
You know, that's what it's about. So everybody in Bulgaria, in the countryside, they make, quite legally, they make their own rakia. And I wrote that song, and I changed it. I don't know if you can hear in the village, it goes, you know, what should we do with the drunken sailor? Now, the traditional English song is, what should we do with a drunken sailor?
Right.
But the Bulgarian word for village is selo. So it's basically, what should we do with a drunken village?
Oh, I did not know that.
Well, there you go. And so it's a song about all of the villagers being drunk on rakia. You know, because, you know, the economy's collapsed, and in the villages there's no work, there's no money, there's no electric, there's no water, there's nothing. So all they do all day, you know, a lot of them, I can't insult everybody, is drink this homemade rakia, you know, like hillbillies drinking moonshine, and just drink themselves unconscious, and of course die at a very young age, tragically.
You know what? I got to do it for our audience, man. Let's hear some of I Love Rakia right now.
What shall we do with a drunken sailor? What shall we do with a drunken sailor? We'll lie in the morning. What shall we do with a drunken sailor? What shall we do with a drunken sailor? What shall we do with a drunken sailor? We'll lie in the morning. I want rakia. I need rakia. I love rakia. We'll lie in the morning.
Well, let's talk a little bit about, you know, your writing endeavors.
I think last time we spoke was probably 3 years ago, and I'd started writing Meat, Memoirs of a Psychopath.
Right.
And I think since we last started, I've just finished my 7th novel. I think it's 14 music CDs, my 7th novel. But all expanding on from Meat, Memoirs of a Psychopath, because what I was trying to do was create something that hadn't been done before, some kind of new literature. So it's a series of books that all fit together, but it's all one book. I suppose the easiest way to, if you think of the Bible, you've got lots of books within the Holy Bible. They're all different books, different authors, etc. But what I tried to do, or hopefully I've succeeded in doing, is each book is of a completely separate genre. So one's science fiction, one's horror, one's detective, one's a country and western romance, etc. Now, I mean, it's staggering. It's now at 250,000 words, the definitive edition, and I'm working on part four now. And if I blow my own trumpet, a bit like you know, Game of Thrones, epic. really loved your last show talking about Game of Thrones. I'll come back to that in a minute. We're absolute fans here. But part four of Memoirs of a Psychopath is epic. Even I'm excited about it, and I know what happens.
Well, you know. Let me say this, you know, as somebody who has read Meat, Memoirs of a Psychopath, you know, all the readers out there that are going to come pick it up and people that have read it already, it's such a fascinating read because, like I say, at first it's like real assault on the senses, and then you go back and then you start getting it, you know, because I think we're ingrained, you know, to read something, and if at first we find it defensive or distasteful, yeah, we're like, ah, this is not for me. And then, you know, you read it again, and then you're like, you know, oh, how, now I get it.
It's really cool for me as well, and thank you for the kindness on that one, is that because each part of the book is written under a pseudonym, so it's, the first book is Dr. Keris Davis, a psychologist, you know, nobody actually knows, unless, like you've done, you plow on through, you never actually find out who's written the book anyway. And it's very interesting. I mean, I've had conversations with people about this book that didn't know I've written it. it's absolutely brilliant, you know, because I wanted to start a conspiracy that was believable from the very beginning, that people didn't quite know what was going on, because you're encapsulated in the bigger story, because you know it's not sadistic, brutal violence for the sake of it. It's a much, much more complex story. It's much more, you know, difficult than that. So, you know, all I would say is if people can manage to get past Meat and accept it, I mean, in its simplest form as a kind of very dark humor, then you're going to have a very, very good experience reading this book. And there are so many twists and turns where, you know, characters are just killed off, or they become something they're not, or the story rewrites itself, or suddenly what you believe hasn't really happened and what you thought happened, you know. I love it. I've got a bias because I've written it, but it's almost become an addiction that I just somehow can't finish this book. You know, I'm on part four and I'm thinking, wow, what will I do when it's finished?
Well,
there's got to be a part five. There's got to be a part six, you know?
Well, you know, Jonathan, you just hit upon something, you know, that is what all writers, you know, that I believe, you know, aspire to. You know, I mean, you said, you know, there's lots of twists and turns and things like that. And there are. The whole essence of a book, you know, is people telling stories, and you want to transport the person reading it, you know, into this different world, you know.
Yeah, I get what you're saying there. Yeah.
Why don't we tell everybody where they can, you know, get music on CD, baby. You'll be a featured artist. I Just Imagine It, Inc. Memoirs of a Psychopath is available on Smashwords, which is a great site. All right. Thank you so much. And Jonathan, once again, thank you for coming on. And we look forward to having you on again.
I'd love to do that. Ed, take care. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
To learn more about Jonathan Taylor, visit us at our website, justimagineinc.com.
Go Set a Watchman, a New York Times bestseller. A historic literary event, the publication of a newly discovered novel, the earliest known work from Harper Lee, the beloved best-selling author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning classic To Kill a Mockingbird. Originally written in the mid-1950s, Go Set a Watchman was the novel Harper Lee first submitted to her publishers before To Kill a Mockingbird. Assumed to have been lost, the manuscript was discovered in late 2014. Go Set a Watchman features many of the characters from To Kill a Mockingbird, some 20 years later. Returning home to Macomb to visit her father, Jean-Louise Finch, Scout, struggles with issues both personal and political involving Atticus, society, and the small Alabama town that shaped her. Exploring how the characters from To Kill a Mockingbird are adjusting to the turbulent events transforming mid-1950s America, Go Set a Watchman casts a fascinating new light on Harper Lee's enduring classic. Moving, funny, and compelling, it stands as a magnificent novel in its own right.
The town of Macomb, Alabama, owed its location to the presence of mind of one Sinkfield, who in the early dawnings of the county operated an inn where two pig trails met, the only tavern in the territory. Governor William Wyatt Bibb, with a view to promoting the domestic tranquility of the new county, sent out a team of surveyors to locate its exact center and there establish its seat of government. Had not Sinkfield made a bold stroke to preserve his holdings, Macomb would have sat in the middle of Winston Swamp, a place totally devoid of interest. Instead, Macomb grew and sprawled out from its hub, Sinkfield's Tavern, because Sinkfield made the surveyors drunk one evening, induced them to bring forward their maps and charts, lop off a little here, add a bit there, and adjust the center of the county to meet his requirements. He sent them packing the next day, armed with their charts and 5 quarts of shinny in their saddlebags, 2 apiece and 1 for the governor. Jean Louise could never make up her mind whether Sinkfield's maneuver was wise. He placed the young town 20 miles away from the only kind of public transportation in those days, riverboat. And it took a man from the south end of the county 2 days to journey to Macomb for store-bought goods. Consequently, the town remained the same size for over 150 years. Its primary reason for existence was government. What saved it from becoming another grubby little Alabama community was that Macomb's proportion of professional people ran high. One went to Macomb to have his teeth pulled, his wagon fixed, his heart listened to, his money deposited, his mules vetted, his soul saved, his mortgage extended. New people rarely went there to live. The same families married the same families until relationships were hopelessly entangled, and the members of the community looked monotonously alike. Jean Louise, until the Second World War, was related by blood or marriage to nearly everybody in the town. But this was mild compared to what went on in the northern half of Macomb County.
Oscar-winning actress and Southern girl Reese Witherspoon portrays the narrator of the masterpiece To Kill a Mockingbird, The story features many of the same characters in Mockingbird, but they're radically different in outlook. All are portrayed by Witherspoon with perfect pitch and pacing, and the sure hand of a talented actress who is well aware of the region's racially fraught past. Lee's new novel draws on the same theme as Mockingbird, empathy. But as Witherspoon wistfully portrays Atticus, Scout, and others, listeners will need to find new ways of understanding them. Winners of Audiophile's Earphones Award from Audiophile Magazine. Harper Lee was born in 1926 in Monroeville, Alabama. She attended Huntington College and studied law at the University of Alabama. She is the author of To Kill a Mockingbird and has been awarded numerous literary awards, including the Pulitzer and Presidential Medal of Freedom. For more information about top-selling titles from this award-winning company, go to downpour.com.
Stay There is a Just Imagine It Inc. presentation and was recorded in the Blackstone Audio Inc. studios in Ashland, Oregon. If you would like more information about this show, or if you or someone you know would like to be featured, please call us at 541-708-0525 or visit justimagineitinc.com. I'm Maya Seligman.
I'm Jerry Renfro.
I'm Holly Lorian Adams.
I'm Kayla Elrod.
I'm Sean Mark Nipper.
And I'm Charlie Stanton, and we like you, so be sure to like us on Facebook. And remember to get behind me.
Now stay there.